925 Fox News.
I'll tell you, I'm so glad to have this gentleman back on the program once again. It's always a pleasure to speak with my old buddy, Dr. John Lott, president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. But understand, John's background is much more than talking about his bestseller, More Guns, Less Crime. John has a PhD from UCLA. He has served in a number of advisor positions in the Department of Justice, the Office of Legal Policy in the U.S. Department of Justice, as well as academic positions at Yale and University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, Stanford, UCLA, and most important, as it pertains to our first topic with John tonight, the University of Chicago, well, where the one and only Milton Friedman, Nobel laureate, said, quote, John Lott has few equals, has a perceptive analyst of controversial public policy issues. Dr. John Lott, welcome back, my friend.
Thanks. I guess I owe you yet another dinner, but I appreciate the plug there.
So. Well, I owe you a check, so, you know, we're even.
Okay.
I bring up Milton Friedman, one of our favorite economists, and I bring up your time at the University of Chicago, the leading monetarist school, has sort of a segue into this first topic. I want to get to the so-called increases in mass shootings and the anti and unconstitutional gun legislation going on around the country and all of that. But you and I, like every American, have an interest in honest figures when it comes to the real rate of inflation. And each and every month, the Labor Department, as well as the BLS, comes out with our price increases for the month, if you will, if you want to call them that. And each and every month, at least in my view, I think they understate inflation. Now, the last month, it was 3.1% change from a year earlier. But the core price increase from the Labor Department was 0.4. Now, what am I missing here, Dr. Lott? If you take a simple math, compound interest that we all learned many years ago, and you take a core price, including energy and food, core price increase of 0.4 per month times 12-month going forward. We're not talking about, you know, looking back. We're talking about prospective inflation. During the month of January, prices were rising at 5% at least, were they not?
Yeah, I mean, 0.4 times 12 is 4.8%.
And then you add the compounding on top of that, right? And it gets over 5.
Sure. Right. Look, the issue that you have is there are lots of different products. Not all of them go up at the same rate over time. So what you include or what you exclude or how you weight it. So, I mean, there are big debates that occur over, you know, what percentage of a person's income gets spent on different products. So you have to weight them by, and that changes because if some products go up in price that month, people may buy less of it. So it's not going to be as much of a, you know,
Let me hold on there for a second. I want to get to what products are in the fixed basket of goods and how we've changed that with substitutions. But just stick with me for just a second on the bare bones calculation, because I think the media are playing fast and loose with this, because it used to be in the old days, they calculated it just like you and I just described. It was going forward. And if it's going forward 4.4% in a month or 0.04 in a month, you calculated that forward during the month of January. Inflation was rising. This all of a sudden, at some point, I think during COVID, but it might predate that, they started looking back a year ago. And am I seeing things or what?
You're exactly right. And it is a very recent phenomenon. If you go back 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 40, you'd find the news would do it always the way you're talking about. They'd say, this is the rate of inflation we've had right now, multiply it by 12 to get the yearly rate. Now, what I think happened was when Biden got in there, you'd had very low inflation, less than 2% under Trump. And when it started increasing during the middle of 2021, by kind of looking over the past year rather than looking prospectively, they were able to kind of make it look like things weren't getting bad that quickly because they had all these earlier months under Trump where it had been very low. And even the beginning of 2021, I mean, it wasn't until you kind of got to the middle of 2021 that you started really seeing increases beginning to occur. They could kind of, you know, make it look less bad than it was. Now, the irony is that while doing that kind of made it so it didn't look as bad when we were going up in terms of inflation and surely the peak. So like they say, the peak would get to, you know, like 9.some%. Mm-hmm. If you took it on the way we were just talking about doing it, it actually got into double digits.
Right.
And but now the irony is that now that they've kind of locked themselves in, at least to doing that, though they're starting once in a while to go and mention it the way we are talking about it, you know, then when they are bringing it down, it still looks relatively higher than it would have been.
Yeah, right. If inflation is coming down.
A year ago.
Right.
But now, so, you know, it's, you know,
it's just dishonest, though. It's just dishonest. It's not a true picture. You talk to any American family out there, and if you told them that prices have really tamed, it's looking good, the Federal Reserve can cut rates again because inflation has been won, we've got a soft landing, we're only growing at 2.5%, 3%. And for heaven's sakes, I can see it in my family, the price of eggs, the price of groceries, the price of gas, the price of energy, the price of home insurance or automobile insurance. There is no way people think inflation is tamed right now.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. Biden and his administration talks about, you know, supply bottlenecks and stuff like that that happened during COVID or immediately afterwards that were responsible. If that's the case, if that really explained the increase in prices, then now that those bottlenecks are relieved, prices should go down.
Right.
You know, but they're not going down. They're just not increasing as fast as they were before. And that, to me, tells me, and I knew this to begin with, and I'm sure you did too, that these claims that it was somehow bottlenecks were responsible for the big inflation that we were seeing just didn't really explain it. And not saying that you can't point to a bottleneck here or there, but it's not going to explain the overall increases in prices that we were seeing. And so, look, this huge increase.
Well, we'll get to the causes here in a second. I think you and I both know what they are, especially given your background and being a Milton Friedman advocate the way you are. But I want to get to that. But I just want people to understand how insidious this is. The cumulative change in consumer prices just since January 2016 shows an increase of 30%. Now, when you're talking about your son or daughter trying to be able to afford a home, a car, the insurance that goes with it, to sustain a 30% increase in the cost of living in 8 years is simply not tenable. You can't function
well,
that
there's
way.
There's no way... I mean, incomes have gone up, but nowhere near that 30%. People aren't, their salaries aren't 30% higher. And so, you know, Biden wants to claim that wages have gone up, but it's relative to inflation, how much have they gone up? And the amazing thing to me is that the media just seems to refuse to, report that. It's the difference between how much inflation went up and how much their wages went up is what people are feeling. And so even towards the end of last year, you were still having months where inflation was greater than the wage growth that was happening there. And so, you know, Biden can go and others can go and claim what a wonderful economy, but people know themselves that their income isn't going as far in purchasing stuff as it was a few years ago.
Well, yeah, real wages have been falling for quite some time, and you just ask any young person.
Well, they were going up under Trump.
Well, that's true.
Real wages.
We tamed inflation in those first 2 years, just like Ronald Reagan and Paul Volcker, and we had the economy growing faster than the rate of inflation. That is true. But over time, this devaluation of the dollar, notwithstanding these good portions during Reagan or during Trump or this or that, has devastated the ability of a younger generation to think they're ever going to own a home.
No, I agree. And you see that in polls and stuff. Look, One of the things that's also happened is,
one of the things that's going to happen is, this is the most insidious way to finance a government spending binge by taking it out of the hide via prices. And it doesn't matter, you know, how you finance government spending, whether you tax, borrow, or inflate. In this case, it's going to come out of people's checkbooks. And where you were going before was, I think, with the notion that during the COVID era, when you throw on the Inflation Reduction Act and the American Rescue Plan combined with an orgy of $6 trillion of spending where we paid people not to work while we shut down the economy, what did people think was going to happen inflation-wise?
No, sure. No, you're exactly right. But where I was going to go is, one of the reasons why wages didn't increase as much as inflation is because of all the new regulations that you have. And that was one of the differences under Trump. I mean, he actually, in a rarity, actually reduce regulations that were out there.
Big time.
And so you impose these costs on businesses, and it reduces how much they're willing to pay workers. And so the increase in their price of the products that they sell is greater than the increase that they're going to have in wages, because all these regulatory costs that are there are putting this wedge between those two sets of numbers that are there.
Can you imagine what it's going to do to first-time automobile buyers if they are forced into the electrical vehicle market?
Oh, sure. No, there are all sorts of costs that are there. I mean, they try to go and give subsidies of $7,500, but and there are other subsidies that they do. There's a great article in the Wall Street Journal recently about how the EPA is dramatically inflating kind of the efficiency of electric vehicles, you know, saying a Tesla gets the equivalent of 400 miles a gallon, whereas under laboratory tests, it's maybe like 60 that's there. And because of the mile per gallon CAFE rules that exist for automakers, where their average car has to have a certain miles per gallon there, it's kind of forcing them to essentially raise the price of the gas vehicles that they have in order to subsidize even further the electrical vehicles that they sell. Because, you know, they have to sell the electrical vehicles in order to have a high enough average miles per gallon for their fleet so that they can sell.
It's such at cross purposes, too. I mean, they were lightening up internal combustion engine vehicles, which were very, very dangerous via the CAFE standards. But now they're trying to sell these overly heavy electric vehicles. They literally don't know what they're doing, except that they'll do whatever it takes to satisfy the climate lobby, which is a clear and present danger. That and more. We'll finish up on inflation, get into some of these mass shootings, because Dr. Lott, who served on the U.S. Sentencing Commission, has focused his economics expertise on crime. The president of the Crime Prevention Research Center as well will continue right after this.
5 Fox News. Right all along.
You know him, you love him, you can't get enough of him. Dr. John Lott, PhD, Dr. Lott, we call him here at the Jason Lewis household. He's an old friend, and he is a very smart guy, and he's doing a yeoman's job on particularly the issue of crime at the Crime Prevention Research Center. And you can tell when you're over the target when everybody's coming after you. And trust me, the gun control fanatics are coming after Dr. John Lott at each and every turn. But I didn't want to let this segment or this opportunity go to waste on inflation, because he spent a lot of time at the University of Chicago with the great Milton Friedman. He knows a lot about inflation. But suffice it to say, before we wrap up that topic, John, that you simply cannot spend. Everybody focuses on how to finance government, but it really is the amount we spend, is it not? It's going to come out of the private economy one way or another.
Right. Well, I mean, there's only three ways you can finance government. You can have taxes, you can borrow, you can go and print up money. any of those ways effectively take money away from people and move it to someplace else that the politicians want it to be spent. And, you know, there are lots of reasons for believing that they're not going to spend it as efficiently as the private individuals do. And the taxes, for example, create disincentives for work, which reduce the amount of output that's going to be there. And, you know, inflation is basically how much money you have there relative to the amount of goods that you have. So if you print up money or you reduce through regulations or taxes the amount of goods that are produced, both of those things are going to increase the prices that you're going to have.
But I don't think the economy could sustain this level of spending. Now, remember, the budget when I went to Congress was a little over $4 trillion. Now it's $7 trillion, and that doesn't even count right. The orgy of special supplemental bills on COVID amounting to $6 to $8 trillion, depending on who's doing the counting. If we had to borrow all of that, or if we had to tax all of that, I think you would have had an economic shock to the system. So the politicians had the Fed write credits on the Treasury checkbook, and we ended up just printing the money. And now that bill is coming due in the cost of living for American households, is it not?
Right. Well, you know, particularly the big COVID bills that were, you know, a couple of years ago, you know, I think they had a big impact on it. The Fed faced massive increases in spending, and they tried borrowing a lot. But, you know, at some point they realized that they had to go and print up some money, and they did.
And they did. And what aggravates me is they arbitrarily weight the basket of goods to measure these price increases, depending on whether you're using, you know, personal consumption expenditures or the CPI calculations. In one particular scenario, food and beverages might be weighted higher than in another. And so it's very, very arbitrary. And now we've got this substitution effect where it used to be we had a fixed basket of goods. And if apples cost, you know, $10 this month and they went up to $11 next month, it was a 10% increase. But now the Fed can say, well, apples went up to $11, but you really don't need apples. You can have, you know, a cherry or two. And it's only gone up half of that. So we'll just substitute cherries and say the inflation rate isn't that high. Isn't that kind of dishonest?
Right. Well, I mean, look, even if you just take kind of the base number that you were talking about before with the 30% increase, I think most people can appreciate that. You know, it's kind of, it adds up. You mentioned compounding earlier. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people see it in their own lives. I know we keep on being told, you know, wages went up. But I think most people know, you know, without going into the detail in the numbers or how they're put together, that their wages haven't gone up enough to match the increased prices that they face. They see that just by going to the grocery store. You know, some prices go up and down a little bit, but overall they know that they've gone up.
Yeah, they sure do. And I think it's becoming unsustainable for a lot of people. And there is a way around that. You can keep a lid on the money supply. You can make certain interest rates are never negative, the Taylor rule. You can do lots of things. And to your point earlier, like we did in the 115th Congress, you can make certain the supply side of the equation keeps up with the demand side by encouraging production.
Right.
And and the Biden administration is precisely the opposite. And quite frankly, so is the Bush administration and the Obama administration.
Right. Well, I mean, Trump was extremely unusual. I mean, maybe it's his background as a businessman who caused him to, you know, actually want to go and cut regulations.
Right.
Unfortunately, you know, that wasn't the view that the Bushes had. Reagan kind of slowed the growth for a while, but at least in my lifetime, Trump's been the only one that's really cut it.
Well, and boy, did we. We went through a Congressional Review Acts. We went through 16 of them in the first 100 days or so of the 115th and took off billions in regulations and millions of man hours off of the backs of business. So that really did get capital and labor back in the market. And then we had I authored the Regulatory Act for guidance You know, they don't count these regulations when they're guidance documents, but they really are regulations. We had lots of good stuff there, and that really it was just as important as the tax reform. Okay, when we come back, I do want to get into what the media would say would be the rise in mass shootings, but there's something that's not quite coming clear here. When you have gun ownership per household at higher levels years ago, but the mass shooting numbers weren't anywhere near they are today, according to the press, it doesn't sound like it's a gun problem. Anyway, we'll talk to the expert, continue with the expert, Dr. John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center and author of More Guns, Less Crime. We'll get into Second Amendment and crime when we return, so don't go away.
92.5 Fox News. Right all along.
Dr. John Lott's claim to fame, if you will, was his best-selling book, now in a couple of editions, subsequent editions, More Guns, Less Crime, created quite a firestorm, although it was based on common sense. I think he'd be the first to tell you that, but that if a criminal suspect has the inkling that someone might fight back, and fight back, quite frankly, with deadly force, they're probably less likely to be assaulted. He's accumulated reams of data over the years to prove that point. He's got it in his book, and he's got it at the Crime Prevention Research Center, of which he runs, and is president, Dr. John Lott, back joining us again. I want to get into this, Dr. Lott, in two ways. One, talk about whether, in your research, mass shootings have actually gone up, and especially in America vis-a-vis, say, Europe, in some areas where there's very strict controls on Second Amendment rights or no Second Amendment rights at all. And number two, whether any of the quote-unquote red flag laws or anti-gun legislation, some real severe stuff that I don't think passes constitutional muster, would have any effect at all anyway. So what does the data show with regard to the rise, or maybe not the rise, in mass shootings over the last few decades in America?
Right. Well, you know, you'll recently hear President Biden, when the Uvalde report came out, he'll talk about there being 650 of these over the last year. When we had the recent mass public shooting in Lewiston, Maine, at the bar there, you'll have outlets from the New York Times to CNN and others go and make similar types of claims. The problem is kind of the source and how the numbers put together. What they're using is are numbers from a gun control group called the Gun Violence Archive. And they say that they're looking at any shooting where four or more people have been injured and or killed with guns. Now, they actually include cases where three people are injured. And when they say injured, that doesn't necessarily mean shot. It means somebody may fall when they're trying to run away or something like that. Those are counted as injured too. But the big problem is they're relying on, well, there are a couple of big problems. Well, one big problem is they're relying on news reports. And overwhelmingly, the types of cases that they're dealing with, like about 80% of their numbers, are basically gangs fighting against each other, kind of like the Kansas City shooting that we just saw recently. And most of the rest are robberies or other things that have happened. Now, nobody's saying that gangs fighting over drug turf aren't important. They are. But to go and talk about something like the Uvalde shooting, where 21 people were murdered, or the Lewiston, Maine shooting, where 18 people were murdered.
Or Littleton, you know, Colorado.
Those are very different. Right. You can go through the list. I was just mentioning some that were getting attention recently. And, you know, the thing is, if you define a mass public shooting as four or more people killed in a public place, not involving some other type of crime like a gang fight over drug turf or a robbery, you're talking about, since from 1998 on, between 1 and 8 of those a year, with an average of a little bit over 3 occurring per year. And, you know, I think you can see the difference in even how the media treats these different types of cases. So people may say, we've been 28 shootings in Chicago over the weekend. But everybody knows that they don't get news coverage. And why don't they get news coverage? Well, the main reason why they don't get news coverage is because they're overwhelmingly drug gangs fighting over drug turf. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the news media realizes that that doesn't grab people's attention. They're not quite as upset by two gangs fighting out against each other over drug turf as you are when somebody goes into a mall or a grocery store or a restaurant or a movie theater or a school with the sole intent of just trying to go and kill as many people as they can so that they can get media attention and people will know that they existed here. And so, you know, the way you stop these mass public shootings is essentially to get rid of these gun-free zones. Anybody who reads the diaries and manifestos for these murderers, and I have to say, one of my big pet peeves is the media just refuses to cover what's in their diaries and manifestos for why they pick the targets that they do. So you take something like the Covenant School shooter in Nashville last year. Mm-hmm. The Biden administration is taking control of the diary and has not released it, though there have been three pages that have been leaked by somebody in law enforcement. But what you find, the day of the attack, the Nashville police chief, before it was turned over to the Biden administration, read the diary and discovered that the person actually had another target that they originally wanted to go after, a mall, the Greenfield Mall there, but had decided not to do that because once they discovered people had guns there and would stop them. You take the Buffalo mass murderer. He has a manifesto where he goes through and explains why he picked the target. He wanted to go to a place with strict gun control because he wanted to go to a place where his victims wouldn't be able to go and defend themselves. And there are dozens of these cases.
Well, I brought up the Colorado shooting for that reason as well.
Right. No, I agree. And so, but the media, you will search in vain. Even though the Nashville police chief held a press conference where he specifically emphasized this particular point, nobody in the national media picked up on it. Why? Why isn't that newsworthy to know why these guys pick the targets that they do? My guess is that the whole gun control debate right now would be very different if once in a while the media would mention things like, well, this guy wanted to go to a place where he knew his victims weren't going to be able to defend themselves. It's not rocket science. These guys are suicidal virtually always. They feel unappreciated. They want to go and get media coverage. And I understand why the media doesn't want to cover the fact that these guys are doing it to go and get media coverage, because mm-hmm. That would put them in an awkward position. But they know if they go to a place where their victims can't defend themselves, they're going to be more successful in killing more people. And you know, it's not... You know, they may be crazy in some sense, but they're not stupid. And
well, there were a lot of things. There were a lot of things about the Nashville manifesto that the media did not want released. In addition to, targeting people that were the most vulnerable, which shows right. You if the manifesto doesn't fit the narrative, they're not going to run with it. Which is another condemnation towards the press and their horrible. Journalistic right. integrity or lack thereof with regard to guns and crime. Have you noticed, however, an increase in school shootings particularly?
No, there hasn't been. I mean,
if you look at other countries.
Right. Well, look, one of the things that people don't do is put these things in per capita terms. So the United States has almost 340 million people in it. Germany, the largest country in Europe, has 80 million. Since 2000, the United States has had 8 K-12 mass public shootings. Germany's had 3, one where 18 people were killed, another one 17 people were killed, another one where 4 people were killed. If you adjust for population, Germany has the equivalent of 12. Because mm-hmm. they have less than one-fourth the population that we have. Finland has had 2 of these K-12 shootings. Mm-hmm. They have 5.5 million people. You'd have to multiply theirs by 60. Now, the media is not going to compare the total number of murders in California with the total number of murders in Rhode Island. Nobody would do something like that. or Florida with Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. What they're going to do is they're going to put these things in per capita terms. That's what the Department of Justice puts out when people talk about how risky different places are, you know, the crime rate in Chicago or whatever, or St. Louis, they talk about things in per capita rates. But for some reason, when they look at these mass public shootings across the world, they refuse to put these things in per capita rates. And look, I can understand to a large extent why a mass public shooting in the United States is more newsworthy for people in the United States than a mass public shooting in Germany or Russia. Russia's had a lot of school shootings.
Right.
It's had the worst, most deadly school shootings. But the, you know, and, you know, gun ownership.
But they want to tie it into, but they want to tie this. The reason they don't do that in Russia or any place else is they want to tie it into guns and the availability of our Second Amendment rights. And that, and running with those stories just doesn't do that.
Yeah, look, there's so many biases there. You know, one of the other things that's kind of interesting to me is that you have cases in the United States where heroic actions with guns have stopped what police say would have been otherwise mass public shootings.
A number of cases.
On our website at crimeresearch.org, since the beginning of 2020, we've had 40 of these cases. The thing that's interesting is that you have something like the Pulse nightclub shooting in Florida. At the time, it was the worst mass public shooting in U.S. history. 49 people were killed. And it was getting coverage worldwide for weeks and months afterwards. 1 week after the attack at the Pulse nightclub shooting, there was an attack at a nightclub in South Carolina. The person had shot three people, was shooting at a fourth when a concealed carry permit holder seriously injured the attack, shot him, and stopped the attack. The guy still had like 125 rounds of ammunition on him when he was stopped. What's the difference? Florida's one of 10 states that banned people being able to carry permanent concealed handguns in establishments that got more than 50% of their revenue from alcohol. South Carolina was one of the 40 states that allowed people to carry in those types of venues. You know,
and the data seem to support that thesis at every turn. That is, if people are more likely to defend themselves, they're less likely to get targeted. And the inverse relationship there, I think, is instructive. And that is, to the degree that the media portray an increase in mass school shootings or any other kind, you would have to juxtapose that next to the notion of gun ownership to draw the conclusion they want. That is, the proliferation of gun ownership has caused these mass shootings. But is it not true that the number of households that have a gun in the household or gun ownership has actually declined over the last few decades?
Well, there are lots of problems with those types of numbers. You know, some recent surveys show that more than 50% of American households have guns. Often the surveys that are done right after a mass public shooting. So some people may be reticent, and I could give you hours of lectures on these surveys, but I'll just give you one example. The percentage of married women who say that a gun is owned by the household is about 15 percentage points less than the percentage of married men who say a gun is owned by the household. You know, maybe guys just want to feel macho and brag about owning a gun when they don't, or maybe they haven't told their wife that a gun's owned in the household. Or maybe women are more reticent, particularly after there's been a big mass public shooting, to go and tell some stranger on the phone that they own a gun that's there. My guess is it's more of the latter than the former there, and we could go into why.
I'm just saying anecdotally, I remember the days in high school where kids would bring their hunting rifles, their 22s, to school and go hunting afterwards. Every household had a gun. It does not, again, anecdotally, seem that that's the case now, and yet the media keeps saying, well, mass shootings are going up because all these people, all these homes have guns.
Right. Well, you know, let's put it this way. there's a lot of problems with the data that you have in terms of surveys, relying on surveys to be able to know whether people have guns or not. One of the sole hard pieces of data that we have are concealed carry permits. And if you look at that, so back in 1998, when I started collecting this data, you'd find, you know, 1.4 million or so American adults had a concealed carry permit. Now you're talking about 22 million mm-hmm. Americans have a concealed carry permit. And on top of that, you have 27 constitutional carry states, including Florida, right. where it's not even necessary to have a permit.
Right.
So we did a survey last year asking people whether they were legally carrying a concealed handgun. And you basically found nationwide about 16% of adults
and that has
were
been
legally carrying.
And to your point, that's been a big increase. So the idea of a correlation, let alone causation, with the rise of concealed carry and crime just isn't there. It's actually been the inverse. It's been safer, to your point. And yet, you've got states all over, you know, let me backtrack and just say, finally, we've got the Second Amendment not being a constitutional orphan, in the words of Clarence Thomas.
Right.
And in you know, Heller and McDonald and all the cases you and I have talked about in the past, it is a individual right, just like the rest of the Bill of Rights. Yet, you've got states like Minnesota that now want to ban the actual transfer of semi-automatic weapons, whether it's bequeathed as a gift, whether it's sold, whether it, basically it is banning gun ownership. That's clearly unconstitutional. And it sort of betrays the fact they don't know what a semi-automatic weapon is.
Right. Well, look, over 85% of the guns in the United States are semi-automatic guns. You know, just so people know, there's basically three types of weapons. You have manually loaded guns, where you fire a round and you have to physically yourself put another round in the chamber. You have semi-automatic guns, one pull the trigger, one bullet comes out, it reloads itself, one pull the trigger, one bullet comes out, and so on. And then you have fully automatic or machine guns, where as long as the trigger is depressed, bullets will come out. There's a big safety reason for people having semi-automatic guns. And that is, you know, if you have a rifle, they ban all semi-automatic rifles, for example, because, you know, you basically have to have manually loaded, you know, bolt mm-hmm. action type rifles. That takes time. And if you face multiple attackers, or you fire and miss, or you fire and wound but don't incapacitate right. the attacker, you may not have the luxury of time to manually reload your gun. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, you know, compare, look at Mexico, for example. Since 1972, Mexico's had one gun store in the country. It's run by the military. Guns are very expensive. The most powerful gun that you've been able to buy in Mexico since 1972 is a bolt action 22 caliber short round rifle. That's not the types of guns that the drug gangs are using down there. You know, so, and you have less than 0.1% of the adult population in Mexico is legally licensed to own a gun. The murder rates have more than doubled since 1972. In some recent years, their murder rates are six times higher than the murder rate that we have in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem that you face is, you may ban semi-automatic guns for law-abiding civilians out there, but you're not going to stop the drug gangs from getting it. You know, one of the reasons why I don't think the media and the liberals who run Kansas City want to go and talk about the yep. shooters there being gang members is that it just emphasizes how difficult it is to go and take guns away from drug gangs.
They're not going to abide. Two policemen in Burnsville, Minnesota were killed. Ostensibly, we're starting to find early information by someone that wasn't supposed to be in possession of a gun already. So you're quite right. They don't work. We are up against the clock as always, but we will have you back very, very soon. Dr. John Lott, always a pleasure. Keep doing what you're doing. I'm Jason Lewis, and we'll see you next time.
Fox News. Right. All along.